Hello, and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by frontman of the Lightning Seeds, singer, songwriter and music producer, Ian Brodie. Hello.
Hiya.
And we're recording it on John Lennon's birthday.
Wow, is that right? It was his birthday today.
Yeah.
I'm not very good at even remembering anyone I know's birthday, so I'm not likely to know that, to be honest. Sorry, John, and posthumous happy birthday from me.
Lovely. Yeah. And you've got a new book coming out, Tomorrow's Here Today.
Yeah, well, it was originally intended to be a book of anecdotes, really, because I was kind of thinking that, you suddenly turn around and it's been 35 years, Lightning Seeds, and longer than that, making record. I think I made my first record with a band called Big in Japan.
Yeah,
in like 1970. Yeah, so a long time ago. And you think the world's changed so much and you kind of don't notice. And then I used to be chatting and maybe sometimes telling stories to pals, and they were like, you should get all this down because it doesn't exist, that world, anymore. So it started from that, and then it became just a lot of anecdotes, and then it sort of changed. It's been fleshed out now with a lot more detail and information, which I'm in two minds about whether I like that or not, but that's how it is.
So, I'll keep it in. And that's out at the end of October, is that right?
Oh yeah, in about 2 or 3 weeks, I think. Yeah, so.
Oh, superb.
Tomorrow's Here Today, which is kind of how it feels, really.
Oh, boy. It happens quicker and quicker every day, doesn't it? I loved you at Glastonbury. That's one of my highlights. What was that like?
Yeah, it was a great day. No, it was really good. It just all came together. I think we've been gradually... The band, I love all the people in the band, and it's been a settled lineup now for about 2 or 3 years, and it's just sort of got better and better, and unfortunately... Glastonbury was a big moment, really, because you're playing to so many people and there's cameras there, and sometimes you can not be that great, and then a week afterwards you're playing somewhere and you think, oh, I wish we'd been like this at Glastonbury. Yeah. But actually it all came together really beautifully on the day. I felt like it all just went how it was meant to be.
Yeah,
I really enjoyed it. It's very hot, but apart from that, I really enjoyed it.
Oh, superb. Oh, it was so good to see you there. And tell me, first of all, obviously this is a Beatles podcast, when did you first discover the Beatles?
So it's funny because when I was a kid, I was born in 1958 and I'm from Liverpool. I was actually born in Penny Lane. So I grew up in a place called Menlove Gardens, which is just around the corner of Penny Lane. It's a road that's off Menlove Avenue. So it's kind of Beatle country, I suppose,
Yeah.
And when I was a kid, when I was 5 or 6, 7, it would be the 60s and it would be... I'd be in Liverpool, it was the 60s, so the Beatles were kind of everywhere. And my parents, no one had, phones, obviously, so they didn't do much filming of us. But we found one undeveloped tape of Super 8, and we developed it a couple of years ago, and it's got me as a little kid on it. And it isn't what I was expecting, but I'm only in it for a couple of seconds every now and again. But the shot is I'm holding with the Beatles over my head,
Wow. Jumping
up and down on a bed. So it's, and I remember my birthday presents from my brother used to be just coincided with Beatles films being out. So he'd take me to see a Beatles film sometimes on my birthday or buy me a Beatles album. Yeah. So I was very young when I was very, very, I think I discovered it at the time. My first live gig, funnily enough, the first gig that I ever went to, my brother, I had two elder brothers, and they were lucky enough, someone got tickets for a Beatles gig. And they'd only given the tickets if they promised they'd take me, even though I was very little. They really didn't want to take me.
Oh.
There was a lot of infighting going on. But in the end, they agreed that I could tag along. So my first ever gig was actually the Beatles in Liverpool.
Oh, wow.
And all I remember about it was I got in. I was pretty little. And all these girls started screaming their heads off, and I started crying. And my brother got really annoyed with me. And he said to me, sit down, put your fingers in your ears, and shut your eyes, be fine. So I saw the Beatles, but I spent the entire time with my fingers in my ears crying my head down. So that was my experience of the live experience of the Beatles.
Nice to watch rather than listen to. Because you, obviously in the 70s, it's when you started producing and all this sort of thing with Big in Japan. And in the 70s, Eric's and that were actively discouraging people to listen to the Beatles. What were your memories of that?
It's funny, really, because I talk about it in my book, actually. So obviously, Eric's was in Matthew Street and the Cavern was in Matthew Street. And there was a pub in close proximity. There's two pubs, actually. There's the Grapes, and round the corner is a pub called the White Star. But the Grapes was the one that everyone used to sort of drink in at the time. So I suppose it would have been about 1976, 77. And, I mean, the last Beatles album was 70. So it's actually a really, in today's money, it's a really short time. But in those days, it felt like a generation. And I think now YouTube and everything keeps things alive. So I remember at that time, you know, discovering the Doors. And, and it felt like they were, you know, who are this? We never saw them. So you'd rediscover things. So it felt like the Beatles had been a long time before. I mean, to be fair, it was a black mark against my character in Eric's that I wouldn't diss the Beatles. I loved the Beatles. and people were not happy about that fact in the organisation of Big in Japan. But it was not regarded as a positive thing. I was like, no, I love the Beatles. And they'd all be like, oh, we hate the Beatles. I love the Beatles. Yeah. But what was kind of weird was, my memory of before we used to go to Eric's, we used to go to this pub, The Grapes. And over in that corner, we'd all be sort of over here. And over in that corner, there'd all be these guys who I just thought were like kind of old fellas. And then there'd be these other guys. And it would be Bob Wooler and Alan Williams and all these kind of Merseybeat musicians.
Yeah.
Who I'd, at the time, just like, they were just, and I was remembering Alan, you know, Bob Wooler had come over and go, you're all in a band, aren't you? Like, you're a punk rocker. I'll manage you. And
really?
No, thank you. It's okay. But looking back now, it would be quite funny for him to manage Big in Japan and the Beatles.
Yes.
So it was a funny situation where the two lives of the city were, you know, right next to each other in the pub in a way, you know.
There's footage of Alan Williams around 76, 77 when he discovered the Hamburg tapes, and he thought he was going to be a millionaire. Didn't quite work out for him. But he was such a character. What are your memories of Alan Williams?
Just hustler, really, in the pub. I mean, I don't have any great memories of him other than, you know, they were funny characters and I liked them. Do you know what I mean? We were just all in the pub, really, and they were of another generation and seemed to have a magical, to me at that time, a magical light around them.
Yeah.
But I didn't really know what it was and I didn't, you know, it was all, I hadn't looked into it. If you know what I mean, it didn't register with me in the same way that now there's a resonance to that whole idea because it's gone. But at the time, like we say, it's only 6 years later.
Mad, isn't it? So tell me about the album you've picked to talk about today.
Revolver is the one I picked. It's weird when people ask you what your favourite Beatles album is because although it was a comedy sketch, my mind always goes to Alan Partridge, who says, the best of the Beatles. And that's how I feel now. You know, I feel like, how do you decide what is the best? You know, it's hard to have a favorite. They all have such a kind of resonance for me and such a strong. Beatles albums just never go away, really, for me. They're like, it's like they're all on a giant circle and they slot in every now and again. And I think, I forgot about this. And so it is really difficult to pick a moment. It's almost like, I mean, for people in Liverpool, well, for me, I always think of it as, there was the Liverpool Beatles and then the London Beatles. And Revolver, to me, is the epitome of the London Beatles.
Yes.
So really, I should probably be picking the first album with the live Cavern set on it. I think there was a moment when they went from being, you know, a brilliant live songwriting band to icons at the forefront of recording technology and experimentation and fashion and the swinging 60s and London and the apex of the world. And I think Revolver is that moment. I think Rubber Soul is amazing, but I think Revolver is just that moment when it turns into an unparalleled situation. I know, you know, Sgt. Pepper's maybe the crown of that, but I think Revolver is just that moment, and in my head, I don't know why, but in my head, Sgt. Pepper's in colour and Revolver's in black and white. Let me tell you how it will be. The
There's one for you, 19 for me. Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man.
So it was released on 5th of August, 66, summer of 66. What a year that must have been. And starts off with track one, George's Tax Man.
Yeah, yeah. Leading with a George track. Blimey, they must have liked it, mustn't they? You know, because he couldn't usually get him on there, really, could he? You know, but I suppose that was just the moment when they were probably experiencing tax issues, and they probably all were very focused on that. But the thing that I remember at the time of that track is humour. It was funny. It's very rare, that, isn't it? You know, it's a funny track, and it's brilliant, and it's a brilliant song, but it's also it's a proper Scouse humour in it. I'm going to have to sneeze. Sorry. Oh, no, I can't.
Oh, I hate that. I hate that. Yay!
Sorry about that.
There it is.
At last.
What's it they say? Seven sneezes were the equivalent to one orgasm, apparently.
Blimey, I better work on the next six.
Could you do it later, please?
In private, yeah.
But, John helped him out a lot with the lyrics on this as well.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
Yeah, but it's weird because you also see him in Get Back. George is still asking John, oh, can you help me with these lyrics?
Oh, yeah, no, definitely, yeah. I think he's sort of saying advice on how to do it more in Get Back, though, isn't he? And John is saying, just make it up and make sense of it later, just talk nonsense and don't worry about it, you know, just don't overthink it. But I don't know, I didn't know he did specific lyrics.
Yeah, yeah. And sonically, it's so stark, it's so raw, it's like the epitome of mod, almost.
Well, I think that's one of the things about Revolver, is it's at the forefront of recording technology, and they're using these techniques, but it absolutely sounds like a band. You know, it absolutely sounds like, you know, music hasn't made that step. Just after that, it's music, a few years after that, actually, music made a step into where, up until a certain point, groups sound a certain way, and making an album is capturing the sound of that group, and then later on it becomes about making a record. And I think Abbey Road is kind of making a record,
yeah,
and Revolver is sort of epitome of, here's a group and they're doing everything and they're experimenting, but it's still a group.
Yeah, they're all together on as one, aren't they, on this?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if they played it all live, but yeah.
Well, on the, yeah, because the box set came out. I don't know if you got that as well with all the outtakes.
I haven't got that, actually. I'm not a big fan of the messing. I love the outtakes, but I don't like them remixing and remastering the albums and all that. It really gets on my nerves, you know? Yeah.
Believe me, I think most Beatles fans are just buying it for the outtakes, but paying for
the
privilege.
You just do the album of outtakes and it would be the same, you know.
But as a music producer yourself, I mean, Jeff Emmerich's obviously involved on this as well. How does it differ from, say, Rubber Soul? Rubber Soul's a very acoustic, soft-sounding album.
Yeah, I think it's the sound of the band that differs, and I think they're more comfortable in the studio. I think they're on a voyage of discovery on Revolver. I think Rubber Soul is probably, they've got a load of songs and they're having a laugh and they're having a great time recording them, and then, you know, they record them in different ways, but it's very song based, whereas I think they're experimenting on, and it's just that moment when they're in between those two things, so they're still a group, obviously it's the Beatles, the fantastic songs, which is the core of the whole thing. As performers and singers, they're really coming into their own, aren't they? They're amazing. The vocals are amazingly confident, and it's almost like everything's coming together. And that's the peak for me, just for me personally. And I know everyone's got a different opinion about it all, but that's, when I mean, like most kids and certainly most musicians, I wish I'd been in the Beatles, you know, and I used to dream of being in the Beatles when I was I was in the Beatles. And you get in a group because you're hoping you might be like the Beatles and the whole thing. But the Beatles I wish I was in is Revolver.
Yeah. You're just making me think, actually, because the humour in this, pretty well all of their albums start with sort of humorous songs, like Drive My Car, as a spoofy lyrics kind of thing, a bit fruity.
Sergeant Pepper.
Sergeant Pepper's then play acting, and then back in the USSR.
Yeah, it's very playful. Humorous. The first tracks are very playful, aren't they? You know, tongue-in-cheek a little. Yeah. Cheeky, actually. Cheeky would be my word. Cheeky monkey.
Eleanor Rigby died in the church and was buried along with her name. Nobody came. Father Mackenzie wiping the dirt from his hands as he walks from the grave. No one was saved. All the lonely people, where do they all come from?
Track 2, Eleanor Rigby.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a, I think particularly that time, to suddenly, it's a Beatles album, second track in, and the Beatles aren't on it. Do you know what I mean? It's an orchestra and Paul, and it's amazing. But it's also amazing to do that, really. I mean, just did any group then do away with the instruments and just sing to, I mean, people had strings on it, but I don't think anyone just had entirely an orchestra and vocal. You know, there's very few records that you take away the drums, you take away everything. It's a rare thing. And you would think that if someone did that on an album, it would be the forgotten track almost, you know. And obviously, that lyrically, it's so, and performance-wise, it's so striking and so immense that it becomes, you know, it's almost an institution, Eleanor, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, the lyrics just transcend it to such a high level. Similar to She's Leaving Home, in many ways.
I was going to say She's Leaving Home is almost like, you know, part two Eleanor Rigby almost, isn't it? You know, but yeah, no, I just think just the idea that there's no drums or bass or guitar, you know, it's quite, we just take it for granted. It's actually mad, amazing, you know,
yeah,
thing to do, you know.
And a double A-side of a single.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't like, oh, we'll just do that and it's a B-side. You know, they obviously put a lot of work into it and realised how special it was.
When I wake up early in the morning, lift my head, I'm still yawning when I'm in the middle of a dream. Stay in bed, float upstream.
Next, track 3, I'm Only Sleeping, with John.
Yeah, I used to love this track when I was a kid. I just thought it was just exactly how you feel when you just want to go back to bed, basically, you know, which I did often feel as a kid. I was always wanting to go back to bed. You know, it was hard to get me out of my bed at some points in life. And that track is just, it's such a, I don't know, it just speaks to, it just, I think, you know, a lot of these songs, they just speak to you on an emotional level that you can't, you know, obviously it's much more obvious on Rubber Soul with in My Life and stuff like that. But to me, this is the same kind of John thing where you wouldn't think of saying to someone, you know, that feeling when you just want to go back to bed. It's lovely in there. It's warm. It's great. You know, it's a funny thing to write a song about, but it's like actually something that is a direct plug into everyone's hair. Everyone knows that feeling, you know? So it's brilliant.
Ken Townsend's artificial double tracking as well gives it such a rich vocal sound, I think.
Yeah, Ken Townsend's artificial double tracking. Why is it Ken Townsend? He's the studio manager.
Yeah, he was the one that came up with the idea.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know that was his idea, yeah. But I always thought it was, you know, you put it through the Revox and you had two settings, 7.5 and 15, and you could have the volume of them. And it's a play on what Elvis used to do, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
Tape head and record head.
Slapback that he used to do in the 50s.
I think that all comes from the distance between tape speed and the two heads on a tape recorder.
You'd know better than me.
I just don't know. I don't know where Ken Townsend fits in, but I'm sure he did.
He was the first one to...
Did he say, you should get a good effect on that track with your voice?
Yeah.
And they did it. Yeah. He was the first one to do that, was he? I don't understand that, but... There you go. I would have thought Jeff Emmerich was the engineer. George
yeah, he
was producing.
He was, but it was Ken Townsend that initially introduced ADT to Jeff Emmerich and George Martin.
That's interesting. I thought I did that. I was round at Abbey Road when I was a kid. And I thought I said, you should get some double tracking on that. And he's taken total credit for it.
Typical Ken. But have you been inspired at all by any Beatles productions on any of your songs?
Do you know, I had a little rule in my head of disregard the Beatles because it's so special and the rules don't apply. I still think that. I always think you just can't do what the Beatles did. There's something magical in those four people, or those six people, those eight people, including George Martin or whoever's around. That moment in time, culturally, what was going on, I just think there's a magic in everything. You know, in literally everything, I think, probably, that they did, that is bigger than the sum of the parts. You know, something about the way they wrote songs, the emotion they put in it, the way the lyrics react to a part of your your emotional setup. I am inspired by it without, you know, obviously, I think everyone in the Western world over the last 4 years, it's a massive influence, you know. But as a rule of thumb, I just think no one can do that. So I try never to go near that, you know.
And I love, obviously, the backwards guitar by George. And he did. He spent all night on it, late night session on 5th of May. And he wrote down the notation for the solo he wanted and then reversed it and played along to that. So it was a specific
guitar solo. It's incredible, really. You know, it's just to be thinking about that. I think that goes back to my earlier point, is just the fact that he was thinking about doing something like that. It's an album of experimentation and a voyage of discovery. They're really trying to find new ways of doing things, you know. And I think you can only do that if the case that you've encircled it all in is brilliant songwriting. And they do that, really, don't they? So that's the wonderful thing about Beatles, for me, it is the fact that, you know, you have albums that are experimentation, you have albums that are songs, you have albums that are grouping. The Beatles are everything all at once. And I think that's what makes it completely unparalleled.
Another George song, Love You Too.
My least favourite on the album, I have to say. And I think this is George. It's kind of good, but he gets better later. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
This isn't George at his peak, is it? Do you know what I mean? It's funny when you look at the songs that he didn't get on the albums. But I think, again, it's all about the instrumentation, really, and the idea. So I suppose while I focused very much on ideas, so I'm not going to diss it. Obviously, it's the Beatles, it's brilliant. But in terms of brilliance, it's not my favourite.
There's always one, isn't there?
And it's me. So I'm not being very specific, am I? You're all about facts and
no, stuff. It's all about emotions and memories. And I mean, where were you when you first got Revolver? Can you remember that?
I'd have gone up to my bedroom, to my little record player, and I'd have played it for days on end over and over again. And I wouldn't have skipped tracks. You know, that's the funny thing about that track. You know, I would have listened to it as an album. You put the needle on, and you listen to the side one and then side two. And then the only thing I would maybe do would be side one three times.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, but I would never just try and get it on a track. I don't think I loved, you know, I used to spend hours listening to them over and over again. You know?
Superb. I remember you hear it telling a story, I can't remember where from, where you were saying about how people bought records in the 70s. So wasn't it the sort of discounted records that helped you discover all these things like the Doors?
The Beatles weren't discounted, though. They weren't.
Oh, to this day.
The local record shop on Allerton Road was Nems, actually. Nems opened a branch on Allerton Road. Mm. But I think that might have been a bit later. I don't think I would have physically gone and bought any of these records. They would have to be bought for me. I think I was too little, really, you know.
Mm.
But, you know, I had two elder brothers, so the Beatles albums would be around the house. You know, and there was a lot of records around the house, really, when I was a kid. My dad would have Frank Sinatra records. You know, my eldest brother would have Dylan, the Beatles, Loving Spoonful, all that sort of stuff. And so sometimes, you know, when you're a little kid, things that are around your house, you don't really question how they got there.
Yeah.
You know, you just think, oh, that's lucky. There's Revolver. You know, I'll put it on.
To lead a better life, I need my love to be here, making each day of the year.
John Lennon's favourite songs, Paul's Here, There and Everywhere.
Yeah, it's funny, it's hard for me taking this album song by song. It's such an overall, maybe it's because that's how I heard it when I was a kid, yeah. You know what I mean? It's such an overall, and there's a lot of albums that, you know, I will cherry pick songs, but this is an album I just put on, you know, I always just put this album on, and it never dips, really, it just never dips. Here, There and Everywhere, it's a very sentimental, emotional song, isn't it? You know what I mean? Brilliant. What's the facts about this one?
Well, it's really how Paul was saying he was influenced by things like the Beach Boys. You know, it's got that, to lead a better life, to have that separate intro. And again, that's going back to sort of music hall songs that his dad and Auntie Betty would be playing. So it sort of dips into different bits of inspiration. Obviously, the Beach Boys and the Beatles at this time was quite the thing. And you forget, like, and Dylan was there as well.
It was a good time. I don't hear the Beach Boys in this. It's funny. I can't.
I think it was more the formula of having a separate intro to a song and then going into the song itself. But I'd say that's probably more music hall era.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just trying to think of things that start like that in music hall. Or, I mean, obviously, Round, Round, Get Around, I Get Around, all that. But
there's some, what's the one? Someone to Watch Over Me. That's got like a separate intro.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the effect it had for me, because he starts that vocally and stuff, it instantly makes it massively personal, and you're right in there in a very personal way. And I find it quite nostalgic, that song. It's almost like, and maybe that's because, which is really clever, the fact that it's, you know, starts off with the vocal. It's almost it's a very beautiful love song to me.
But as you say, yeah, as you listen to it, an album, you think the end of Love You Too, this mad, crazy fade out, then into this. It's such a lush, different experience.
Yeah, and it sets it up, doesn't it? You know, they set it up. See, that's why they've got that on there.
Yeah.
I'm only kidding. To set up that, it's kind of...
Yeah.
Do you know what? I can imagine Paul now. Do you know what? Make my song sound great. You're the one there. Only kidding. That's just my sense of humour. Sorry.
And you know that really shit song. That really shit one, George? I know we put it.
I'm only joking, obviously, and I do like that track. I do like that track. It's just, and actually, funnily enough, on a serious note, that is what albums are about, you know, or were about. You know, it was about how one song made another song sound, setting the atmosphere and setting it up, and people would spend a long time on the order that they wanted you to hear things in. You know, and how one side would work, then another side. And that's something that's totally changed, you know. It's just something that just doesn't exist anymore. But it would, you know, it would have been a consideration. And just even how long the gap between those tracks are. I can promise you someone will have thought long and hard about that.
Yeah. Is that, if you're compiling your own albums, is that how the way you think of it?
I think everyone does, but it's less now because people generally do their own lists on Spotify, and Spotify, the gaps aren't as you might do them anyway. They do it how they do it. So it's very much to the ear of the song, not the album now, I think. You know? But certainly, a lot of stuff would be considered, you know, because sonically, you know, there's an optimum amount of music that will sound good on a vinyl album. You know, and you probably would have tried to not go too far beyond that. I remember the first track that I ever had mastered, which is, you know, once you've mixed it, it was the person who had the lathe and who would master it onto vinyl. And it was a guy called Porky, who was from Liverpool, funnily enough, but he didn't work at Abbey Road.
Porky Prime Cuts.
Yeah, he obviously did. But at that time, he was at a place called ICB, I think, in Regent's Park. I don't know if he was ever at Abbey Road, but he did do the Beatles stuff and all that, you know. Yeah. And he used to put his little messages in the, in the thing. And I love that, you know, that whole thing. And I was so thrilled to meet him when we did that. You know, it was like meeting, I don't know. He's like, you did the Beatles one?
Yeah.
Wow.
As a kid, I ruined albums because I saw somebody pointed out the Porky Prime Cuts, look at his little messages. I think I had it was a Monty Python album, and there's a little message in there in the inner groove.
Right.
And I thought, I might do this to some of my brother's records.
I bet you he loved that.
to this day. Well, unless he listens to this, he'll die with me.
Live a life of ease. Every one of us has all we need. Sky of blue and sea of green. In our yellow submarine. We all live in a yellow submarine. A yellow submarine.
And yeah, and like you say, yeah, Love Me Too setting up Here, There and Everywhere. And Here, There and Everywhere sets up Yellow Submarine.
Yeah, which is such a great track, isn't it? You know, and it's Ringo singing it and the harmony and the iconic imagery of Yellow Submarine, which now, however many years on, say the words Yellow Submarine, everyone gets a picture of that submarine, don't they? You know what I mean? And it's worldwide. And it's, who writes songs about Yellow Submarines in 1966? What are the band that are writing that? You know, and it's, you know, it's almost stranger than truth, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? It's an amazing thing, really. And at the time, that stood out a little bit to me. It was like, this is a funny track. Yeah, it was almost, you know, in a crowdy sing and a bit silly and a bit kiddish. And it is staggering to think that all these years later, it's such an iconic thing. I mean, you know, I go, when I'm in Liverpool, there's a yellow submarine going up and down the river. Actually, I think it's sunk, to be fair. I'm not sure if it's still operational. I think it is a submarine now, unintentionally. Yeah, it's obviously, it's a quirky track, you'd say, wouldn't you? But it's had immense power in its imagery, you know, and sentiment, really, you know.
Yeah. It's a strange comparison with A Day in the Life, because it was John and Paul wrote this, because Paul came up with the chorus and he said he was lying in bed one night and he said, it's that moment when you're falling asleep, that little twilight moment when a silly idea comes into your head. And I just thought, we all live in a yellow submarine. It's a typical Paul story, you know, oh, I was just having a dream and yeah, yellow submarine, you know. But John's, it's heartbreaking. It was that demo on the box set that came out. And the lyrics were originally, in the place where I was born, no one cared, no one cared. And it's how gluing them together, how the behemoth of Lennon McCartney transformed what... Because it could have gone either... Well, I suppose it couldn't have gone either way with that chorus. But how, you know...
But still, it's his willingness to change that as well. Yeah. And not be... So many people, when they've got something... You know, as a producer, you work with so many people and they get so intransigent about things, you know what I mean? And they lose sight of stuff. And just the idea that he is up for changing that lyric to go with that, it shows a real creativity, I think, you know what I mean? And a sort of, yeah, it just, you know, it does. And it's obviously, it's a great melody, you know, it's a great melody.
It's obviously the chorus dictates the concept of the song. But the fact that there's such a nautical theme, Matt Everett was on before, and he was suggesting that it subconsciously might have been about John's dad, thinking about his dad that was never there, and in his mind he'd replaced him with this hero at sea that he probably wasn't, but I love that idea. Yeah, it's probably not true.
Yeah, Well, I think everything's true in a way when it comes to songwriting, and even with your own songs, when you're lazy, you think, bloody hell, you know, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's really possible, isn't it? You know, it's, you know, who knows what he was thinking? I mean, obviously it was Paul who came up with the whole nautical thing. So I don't know if that was going to put up, but I certainly think that's the funny thing, isn't it? So it's a quirky song about a yellow submarine, but it's very emotional again. It's not throwaway.
Yes.
And it's not, and like you say, you know, a man who sails to sea who's telling you of his life. I mean, it's the old man in the sea, I suppose. You know what I mean? Like Hemingway or whatever. Yeah. And underneath that quirky line, it's quirky, but it's not throwaway in any sense of the word. And as soon as you start thinking about it, you know, I'm sure you can read more in than was intentionally put in there. Yeah. But subconsciously, I don't know what was put in there. You know what I mean? It could be a million things, you know, John's dad being in Liverpool surrounded by ships and docks and all the old fellas in the pub telling you about stuff. You know what I mean? It's a seafaring town and the people from Liverpool at that time, you know, certainly 50s and 60s, you know, they went everywhere in the world and came back. And I suppose it was the ultimate cosmopolitan kind of exchange, really. You'd be sitting in pubs by the docks and you could be talking to someone who was in Jamaica a week before, or well, longer than that. But do you know what I mean? So all that's mixed in there, isn't it? Could be his dad, could be being in Liverpool, could be surrounded by the ships. Probably it's just in your soul, the whole seafaring thing.
And again, I'm loving this, actually, comparing the end of one song to the other. So the end of this one, you've got Mal Evans banging the bass drum while they're marching around the studio. And then into the screaming guitar of She Said, She Said.
She said, I know what it's like to be dead. I know what it is to be sad. And she's making me feel like I've never been wrong.
What a sound that is. So, you know, the sounds of those guitars are so, you know, on that whole album, they're so biting, but kind of, they feel like they were played. It's, yeah, I don't know, it's like every note is, it's got everything put into it, hasn't it, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, it's fully committed.
Yeah.
It's full commitment. And I think that song's like that. It comes in, it's just like, we're holding nothing back here, you know, bang.
I think it's just the instrumentation, like you say, because there was rumours that Paul wasn't on this. I think what it actually was that he was on the backing tape, because that's definitely him on bass. But I think there was a bit of an argument. So it's only John and George singing, which gives it a different... I love it. I love the sound of John and George singing together, because they both kind of got a similar nasal twang. And it gives it a real, I can't explain it, it's some a unique Beatles sound, because Paul's not on there, and I love it.
Yeah, yeah. I was on Instagram the other day, actually, and they have all these people, you know, doing these variously nutty things, and there's these guys, they're all in a room together, and they cover Beatles songs in a very exact way. And it's funny, and she said, from that came on. And it sounded, as you know, even them pretending to be it struck me, you know, what a unique sound it was. And to hear someone trying to copy that sound, it made me think, wow, you know, that is, it's on its own, that track, where it is. Do you know what I mean? It's just, you could probably have a genre that came down from that playing. I mean, when were the Birds? Was slightly before that, weren't they? You know, it's the ringiness, but it's like, whereas the Birds is golden and hazy, it's like a razor version of an electric. It's kind of doing a totally different thing.
Because the Birds were effectively copying George's 12-string on like Hard Day's Night album, but doing it in a different way, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, but they're doing it in a quite, you know, I always think the guitar on that's like a laser. It's like a white light kind of thing. You know, it's more nearer the Velvet Underground than the Birds, you know. It's almost like it's got that kind of sitar-y phasiness to it, you know, which you get from the Out of Tuners. Which I suppose he would have been drawn to, but anyway, it's great.
Mm. I do love the middle eight on this. It's just, when I was the boy, everything was right. Everything was right. Goes into that strange, typical John rhythms. It's 4-4 and 3-4.
It's like Ringo says, though, isn't it? You know, when they'd say, "Well, I just plow through."
Yeah,
I don't think he ever, you know, play whatever you like. I'm playing this, which is part of what's great about it. Really, is that, you know, they don't complete whatever that might be. They don't go all the way. It doesn't turn into Dave Brubeck or something. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
plows on.
Yeah,
a little bit of a kind of, it almost splits a bit and then comes back together, you know.
Yeah,
but that tension stays in it, because, you know, the idea of actually changing timing in the middle of a song, that could be a disaster, really. But they do it, but not all of them do it. That's what's so great.
Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine. Sunshine. I need to laugh, and when the sun is out, I've got something I can laugh about. I feel good in a special way. I'm in love and it's a sunny day.
So grab the LP, flip it over, side two, and we start with Good Day Sunshine.
Yeah, just a feel good song, isn't it, you know? It's hard. Actually, it's a hard album that I've picked, I think, because they're very much the same. A lot. It's got a real unified kind of sound. And like I say, yeah. They don't really dip and they don't. But that's a great starter side too, isn't it? It's like extremely positive, a massively positive shot in your arm in a way. Very hopeful. It's 1966. He's sitting in London. You know, anything's possible.
Because John and George had seen The Loving Spoonful play at the Marquee in April. This was recorded in June. And
do you think that was influenced by that? Is that what they say?
Paul said, yeah, it's pretty well a nod to What a Day for a Daydream.
Yeah. I saw a Loving Spoonful documentary where they talk about coming to England and the Beatles being at the gig. And it almost being like, wow, we've come to London and there's the Beatles, you know. Which is kind of, I suppose, if you're an American band, that's like your dream, isn't it? You come, do two shows, the first show, who's sitting there, you know, the Beatles. But yeah, I guess so. I mean, is he just talking about lyrically? Or
I think it's the chord sequence. Yeah, the chord sequence really, and just the overall feel. It's the same sort of rhythm as well, isn't it? That's his quote. He says, yeah, it's a nod to Loving Spoonful Staggering, the same traditional, almost trad jazz feel. That was our favourite record of theirs. Good Day Sunshine was me trying to write something similar to Daydream. John and I wrote it together in Kenwoods, but it was basically mine. He helped me with it.
Yeah, I can't hear that terribly. I mean, that's the other thing as well. You know, it's a real talent when you're that gifted a musician and you're influenced by a song to end up not too close to it. You know, I think sometimes when people say stuff like that, they almost expect it to be an imitation. Oh, you can hear, and I can't hear it really. I can't hear that in that at all. But I completely get that that's where his head was at. And I love the fact that even though that's where his head was at, I don't really get that vibe from it. It's a totally different, it just doesn't relate to that song to me. But I get that that was an inspiration for it. And I think it's a real compliment that it doesn't end up anywhere like it.
Yeah, I love the bit at the end where he goes, "Good day, sunshine." He just does it a couple of times at the end. Always gets me there.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds like they were having a lot of fun doing this, even when they're arguing. I love the idea that they have an argument and he goes off and then John and George sing it anyway. Do you know what I mean? I love the idea. That's like a proper group to me.
Your bird can sing.
What a track. This is like from another planet to me. This is like some alien has come down to Earth and gone, here, I'll have that. Because I don't know where that's going. So you're going to tell me where that's coming from. That's probably influenced by Engelbert Humperdinck or something. In a trad jazz feel.
There's a few rumours it might be about Marin Faithful. I'm not so sure. I don't think it is. I think it is just like the wordplay of Dylan that was going around at the time. John's getting more poetic.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing just fits together. And I love the outtake where they're all laughing, doing the backing vocals and just having such a great time, you know. And yeah, it just, I just feels like it would have been great playing that. So it's the sort of song that you'd love to play if you're in a band. I think you just feel fantastic playing that song, you know. It's just got a certain energy within it. I just think it sounds like they're having a great time doing it, and it doesn't really sound, I don't think it really relates to anything, any other Beatles songs really. It's just like one on its own.
And that middle act is Christmas. It's suddenly, it's a bit of Christmas.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of nursery rhymey stuff on that album. Maybe that was a moment, you're talking about John earlier, maybe he is thinking about his past and stuff like that, but there's a lot of, it's almost like that could be Hickory Dickory Dock or something, couldn't it? You know, it's almost, I think the middle eights on a lot of these songs, they take you to a sort of dream sequence. If it was a film, it's almost like they're not a bit of the song, they're all like little capsules of dream, and then you go back to the song, you know, which it's not what they don't do that so much on other albums, I don't think, but on this there is this like these little bubbles in the middle of the song that take you to and then you go, oh, right, we're back in the room. You know what I mean? And I love that, you know.
Apropos of nothing, when we because we met at the Mark Ellen and David Hepworth thing with John Higgs, and you did tell me a story about when you were in a cafe and someone recognised you.
I remember, you'd have to prompt me a bit.
I think somebody kept looking at you and saying, I know who you are.
Oh, no, that's true. I think sometimes, it's funny, I was back in Liverpool the other day. I'm there a lot, actually, because I live between the two places. But I was in a Turkish cafe, actually, a Turkish supermarket. And there was a Turkish guy with a kind of Turkish meets Scouse accents, which was a great accent, you know. And he said to me, I was buying something. And he said to me, where are you from? And I said, yeah, I'm from Liverpool, you know. He said, you know, you haven't got a Liverpool accent. And I was like, I have got a Liverpool accent. It's just, I said, you've got a weird Liverpool accent because you're kind of, it's like two things. Oh, yeah, I've been here, you know, 33 years, and but you don't sound like you're from Liverpool. And I was like, I think, don't know why, but my accent is like an old-fashioned Liverpool accent. It's not the modern accent. I think Liverpool accent changes a lot. So when I'm in Liverpool, I get asked a lot where I'm from.
Really?
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah. But when I'm in London, if I get in a taxi or something, they'll often say to me, you're from Liverpool, you sound like the Beatles. And so I think my accent must be like the Beatles accents. But it's not really a modern Scouse accent.
Because somebody said before that parts of Liverpool, the Beatles, you can tell pretty well where they're from because there's slight variations in the dialect.
Yeah, there is. And I think mine must be, you know, a bit of an anachronism from the area that I'm from. Because even my brother, who has lived all his life in Liverpool, our accents are quite different. But it's funny. So when I'm not in Liverpool, I always get asked, and they always say I sound, you know, my accent's like the Beatles, if I'm in America or something. But when I'm in Liverpool, they ask me where I'm from.
But I do remember the story you were telling me, where you were saying you were in a cafe and someone said, I know who you are.
Oh, they thought it was Ringo.
Yeah.
It was a very young girl, and she was like, I know who you are. And when you were in the other day, I checked you out online, and some quite good stuff. Like, who do you think I am? And then she said, oh, really? I said, no, I'm a lot younger than that. But you're right, they have got some pretty good stuff.
When your bird can sing, it just ends on that ding ling ling ling.
Yeah, like a dinner bell.
And then we get for no one.
Your day breaks, your mind aches. You find that all her words of kindness linger on when she no longer needs you. She wakes up, she makes up. She takes her time and doesn't feel she has to hurry. She no longer needs you. And in her eyes you see nothing. No sign of love behind the tears cried for no one. A love that should have lasted years.
It's great, isn't it? You know, it's just, they're on a roll.
It's another story song. It's the influence of Paul Living with Jane Asher. So many of these songs, like She's Leaving Home and this and Eleanor Rigby, they sound like sort of films from the
little vignettes, kitchen sink dramas. Yeah,
really evocative of the time.
Yeah, I suppose there would, you know, there'd be a lot of that going on as well, wouldn't there? There'd be a lot of see some great little documentaries from then, don't you, about, you know, working girls. I forget what, there's a famous one, isn't there? Is it Ken Loach with, and they're all singing Beatles songs, actually going down with the prams and all that. Yeah, and you know, I think they are little vignettes, and they would have been, but they're also kind of, I think the first time socially things like that are being highlighted, almost really, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on about, you know, people wanting to spread their wings, and in the 60s, it's the year 66. It's not the free love of six, you know, of later on, but it's almost like, I think there is an element behind those little vignettes of people wanting to break out of the roles they're forced into to a degree, isn't there? You know what I mean? It's kind of about breaking the mold and not staying at home. And to a degree, they've all got that in the heart of them, maybe.
Yeah. And I think it's a very sad song lyrically, similar to what Ellen Rigby. It seems to be any time there's a sad song, Paul will sing it about another character, you know. Maybe yesterday, actually. No, I'll take that back. That's not, is it? But, he's very happy to play the part of somebody else. Oh, that's Sergeant Pepper would subsequently show.
Yeah, I mean, I do think they're songs. I think you inhabit them for a while. You know, so a lot of those songs that you described, what they do in an amazing way is create a picture and an atmosphere. So they create their own context, you know, which is a really hard thing to do in songwriting, I think, you know, and they instantly, with the sound of them and the first couple of lines, and, you know, they create a context and they create a world, and you kind of, and for no one, a few lines in, you inhabit that world. You know the rules, you know what's going on, you get it, you get the situation. And that information, I don't know quite how they impart that information. That's the magic of it, I think. You know, I don't know how I get that out the first, but instantly, and you get it, don't you? And I think that's, it's not, you know, that to me, that's the interesting thing, is how that magic that goes into it from him. Being my friend, I said you called up a robber. Day or night, he'll be there any time at all. Dr. Robert, you're a new and better man. He helps you to understand. He does everything he can. Dr. Robert.
Next up, John's Dr. Robert.
This is a funny song, isn't it? About the guy who used to give him all the pills and everything.
Yeah. Dr. Robert Freeman.
Yeah.
He ran a discreet clinic in Manhattan. And yeah, he was known as Dr. Robert, or the Great White Father.
Right. Yeah. So they're writing about characters they meet that they're probably encountering a lot of things in the world that they, as scousers around the town, they wouldn't encounter. And all of a sudden they're encountering all these people and things that they wouldn't have even known about. No. And so you got Ray Davies writing about stuff going on in his front garden in London. Yes. But the Beatles are in New York with some weird doctor. Yeah, you know what I mean? But it's the same thing, isn't it? They're just writing down what they see, really, and singing about it.
Well, the same with Peter Fonda on She Said, She Said, you know, another drug-crazed party.
Yeah, yeah.
And but it is, when you say, yeah, Ray Davies, it's very similar to the sort of stuff that Paul's doing about the kitchen sink drama.
Well, they're little vignettes, aren't they? Yeah. Yeah, little stories. But I think they're experiencing things. The Beatles are now experiencing, it's like the world full on, aren't they? Do you know what I mean? And however weird and wonderful that might have been, I don't know. But I would imagine they're getting bombarded with stuff that, you know, would amaze them, you know, and would open their eyes.
Did you ever hear the story about Autumn Almanac?
No.
Oh, I'll just play you this.
I love the middle age of it, Autumn Almanac.
Well, there's a story behind that. Let me just grab. So the bridge to the Kinks Autumn Almanac was composed first. So the bit, this is my street. And to complete the song, Ray thought what he would do, he played that section backwards, which not only gave him the tune and the melody, but also the title.
I love that bit of that song.
Right.
Can you play that again?
Yeah.
So what is it?
It's the, and I'm gonna stay. And then afterwards it's my autumn almanac. I'm always gonna stay.
It's an autumn almanac. So what's the last thing where it goes autumn almanac? Is that backwards?
Yeah, the first bit is the second bit backwards.
Where does he say, I think I'm going to stay? I thought it was, this is my street and I'm never going to leave it. Yeah, I'm always going to stay here. If I live to be 9, to be 99.
Yeah, just before that.
And I think I'm going to stay here.
Yeah.
Wow, amazing.
What that tells us, I have no idea about Revolver, but there we go.
You've gone down a bit of a wormhole there. Yeah.
Oh man, this is my life. That's all I ever do. Third George song, I Want to Tell You.
why is there so many George songs on this album? I've never noticed that before. You
know? I think John wasn't coming up with too many, and George was getting and into it, really.
Yeah, amazing. I want to tell you. When I'm at a sound check, I always tend to play the riff off the song. It's just such a great riff to play. It's like my two favourite riffs when I was learning guitar was that, and this could be the last. The Stones one, the last time. And I love the riff on this song. Yeah, it's kind of just a song, this, isn't it? There's not much to say about it. It's just a song. It doesn't have the atmospheric kind of depth of some of the bits on the album, but it's just a cool song, you know.
I think with the exception of Something and Here Comes the Sun, pretty well all of George's songs are George songs. They're not written as Beatles songs, I think. You know, Lennon and McCartney were writing them as a Beatles song.
Yeah, it's funny, though, when you listen to All Things Must Pass, some of them are more Beatley than the ones he has on the Beatles album.
Yeah.
You know, isn't it a pity? That sounds really Beatlesy. But he couldn't get that on an album, could he?
No.
You know, they wouldn't let him. He had that for a while and they wouldn't put it on there. Which I kind of get, because there's no chorus, really, and I think. So there's no chorus to it, I suppose.
But that is the point, though, isn't it? Because then he had that, and he had All Things Must Pass.
Yeah, which are very Beatlesy, I think, you know.
And he couldn't get them on the albums.
Yeah, but the ones that are on the albums are more... I get it, actually, because I think the more Beatlesy ones, they've got covered, haven't they? Because Lennon and McCartney are writing the Beatlesy ones. So George's ones on the album have to be something a bit different to sort of have their place on the album in a funny way, I think.
Well, that's the irony of, like, Abbey Road. They're very sort of solo John, you know, like Come Together is nodding to his solo stuff. And I don't know, Maxwell's Silverhammer, maybe? No, probably a bad example. But, you know, it sounds more of a solo. George sounds the most Beatley of all of them, his songs.
Well, Something, yeah, you know, it's probably Here Comes the Sun. And I mean, in a Beatles songy way, they're the two standout songs on Abbey Road, aren't they? I mean, they're not necessarily my favourites. I do love Come Together. But they are almost quintessentially Beatly, aren't they? And it's George writing them, you're right, yeah.
I was alone, I took a ride, I didn't know what I would find there. Another road where maybe I could see another kind of mind there. Then I suddenly see you, ooh. Did I tell you I need you every single day of my life?
I just love the diverse songs on here, from that into the Stax, Motown, Got to Get You Into My Life.
Yeah, just like Eat Your Heart Out, Otis Redding, innit? Yeah, so, I mean, some songs you think, they'd stopped playing live by then, hadn't they, I think?
Well, no, they were about to go on their final tour.
Okay, so I think this is the song that you'd think, this will be great live. You know what I mean? It's that kind of size, the sort of song you go, yeah, no, this will be great live, won't it? You know, and I could imagine it would be.
Yeah, well, again, this box set, you've got to get the box set, Ian, seriously, because the outtakes.
Which box set?
The Revolver one.
Revolver box set, okay. Yeah.
Throw the remixes away.
Yeah.
But there's such a good outtake of this where... The guitar part is doing what the brass section is doing.
Okay, yeah.
And
yeah.
So that they obviously thought, oh, well, actually, no, we'll get brass in to do
get
that.
Get a bit of brass in, yeah.
But they could easily have done that live. Imagine that live in 1966.
Yeah, yeah. No, so I think it feels like a song for the live set, that.
But if they were doing the Paperback Writer, is really difficult for them to do live with all those harmonies. This would have been easier, I would have thought.
Yeah, it's a shame they couldn't play live a bit more, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, and the day after they recorded this, they did the promo clips for Paperback Writer and Rain.
Right.
And Lindsay Hogg.
In Kew Gardens, those ones.
Yeah, yeah. Which I love, because we now know exactly what they looked like when they were recording this.
Yeah, yeah. Tired.
Yeah.
Dying. It is not dying.
with Tomorrow Never Knows.
Which is just, yeah, that's, again, it's a song on its own, that, isn't it? It means something, you know, had anyone else ever done something like this at this point? I don't think so. No. And you've got the loop stuff going on in the back, it's got the beat, but just the whole concept of the song, it's just, it's not, you know, the Fab Four going in to record a couple of songs. It's something different. It's like a gateway to another world, really, this. And I understand the loop thing and that there were, you know, John Cage and all those people doing those classical things with looping and stuff. And obviously that's, in a way, the way modern music has gone is circles, you know, loops and samplers and take it and circular and things being programmed and dance music and everything. It's kind of a forerunner to all that, really, because technically, I think, just because it's a circle, it's not a journey like a song, it's a circle. So it's like the start of a whole different thing, really, I think.
What an ender. I mean, I guess you would have been too young to heard this at the time, would you? Or?
No, I think I'd have heard it on the album.
So what would it have been like hearing it for the first time as a kid?
I think I'd have just thought, wow, it's Red Indians. I love that. I think I was just mesmerised by this album when I was a kid. You know, I really was just sort of mesmerised by it. And I used to just play it. I used to be very, as a kid, I was really obsessed with records. You know, my parents used to worry about it, actually. It was a bit of a thing. You know, they were quite worried about it, you know, and I'd sit there for hours just playing things again and again and again. And this would have been, you know, I would have had a long stint on this one, really. So I know it's a funny thing to say, but I just wouldn't have separated it. It would have just been the album. I wouldn't have thought, oh, that track's funny. It would have just been the album Revolver. In my head, it's the album Revolver. And they all lead into each other. It just really works as a concept, as an entity, you know. And it sets a certain atmosphere. And, you know, my overwhelming memory, honestly, is I wish I'd been there. I just used to sit and think, I wish I was there. I wish I'd been there. You know, I wish I could be there, even though that's not a place. It was like a place to me. It was like something I wished I could be there. A place, but even though it's not a place, obviously, you know. But if I could have gone and lived in Revolverland, I would have gone.
So overall, Ian, what does this album mean to you?
It reminds me, I mean, just funny imagery. It reminds me a lot of my childhood. It reminds me of foggy nights where you could hear the foghorns from the river. It reminds me of really like wintry weather. I don't know if it came out in the winter, but I just imagine it being really frosty. And I think the music sounds like that. The music sounds kind of like you're taking it out the fridge. Like a lolly ice. Do you know what I mean? It's like really like come out of the fridge and it's fresh and it's zinging. Yeah. It's wintry. And it's like an energy. There's an energy in it. And some Beatles records are like a warm coat, fur coat that you just drape yourself in. But this isn't like that. You know, Rubber Soul's a glass of wine and a lovely red wine. But this is a lolly ice from the fridge, you know, in the middle of winter. In the middle of winter, in a frosty field. To me. So this obviously says more about my psyche than anything else, but that's how I see this album, you know.
Ian Brody, thank you so much.
Thank you, that was lovely. Cheers. Thank you. Hey!